So, welcome to the Alton Brown Cast, a little audio project I put together because I miss adult conversation. Adult conversation free of the agendas so often inflicted by publicists, handlers, and press hounds onto late-night chat shows. Adult conversation free of invasion by phones, tablets, laptops, or any of their ancillaria. And no, not all of the conversations you're going to hear here will be food-centric. There are other things to talk about. That said, following today's chat, I will attempt to answer a small collection of culinary queries from the interwebs. But first, I have to confess I am not a super big fan of magic. That is the work of illusionists. Although I've always had a serious soft spot for Penn and Teller, the large-scale histrionics of David Copperfield and the like have always kind of left me cold and rolling my eyes. Then a good friend invited me to a show at the Geffen Playhouse on the campus of UCLA. It was called In and of Itself and featured a rather forlorn-looking young man named of Derek Delgadio. Now, I did not know that the Academy of Magical Arts had named Derek their close-up magician of the year in both 2011 and 2012, or that his show would change my entire concept of what magic is and what theater as an art form can do. The show unfolds like a memoir, a personal tale, in a tiny space holding about, I don't know, maybe 100 people. The tricks, if you can call them that, kind of weave through the narrative and serve to underline these kind of emotional stories he tells. And the tricks are dumbfoundingly, ridiculously, jaw-droppingly good, though Derek tends to play them in this kind of deadpan, offhand manner. Instead of hocus-pocusing them, he simply makes something impossible happen and then shrugs and walks away. Anyway, the show was so good that I went back and saw it a second time and then got up the nerve to ask Derek to be on the show because I got to tell you, this is someone I would definitely like to enjoy a lot of conversations with. Oh, and if you ever get an opportunity to see this guy perform, do not miss it.
My name is Derek Delgadio.
What do you do for a living? When people ask you that, when you have to fill out a paper that says, what do you do? No, we're talking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm curious as to what, because when people ask me, you know, fill in what you do, it's like,
it's hard,
I
right?
don't, I'm a
what day
polyhyphenate,
is it?
And
yeah,
so what do you say? I'm a magician?
No, I'm the same way. It depends on the day of the week. I don't have a specific answer, and it depends on whom I'm speaking to. And
so you're filling out a loan application right now. You got to put something on the line. What do you say?
So I don't get loans. I don't even bother. That's that one question turns me off. I don't want to get a loan.
When people ask your mom, is your mom still alive, by the way?
Yeah,
which is
she's
not
alive.
Something I could tell from the show.
Yeah.
When people ask your mom, what does your son do? What does she say?
She definitely probably says magician for sure.
And then people go, oh,
yeah.
How interesting.
Google him. That's what she, that's
she'll say. Google him.
I don't know. Probably.
Has your mom Googled you? Do you think?
I'm guessing. I'm guessing she has.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
has she seen the show?
She has. She's seen it twice now. She saw it last weekend and opening night.
She saw it opening night.
She saw it opening night and she saw it last weekend. Yeah.
All right. Well, I didn't mean to dive in there. The reason that I wanted you to come do this. I'd only heard of you in kind of a very distant way, then I saw the show taken by my lawyer and was struck by, oddly enough, certain cultural similarities between you and I.
Okay.
Which come down to that we both have an evolving idea of what art performing and performing art are. You're now taking, for lack of a better term, magic, which seems coarse for some reason, and turning it into a very different kind of theater. And now I've found myself taking food programs and now turning it into a stage show that occupies a huge amount of my time. So I started really thinking about what it is that you do in your context that is meaningful and different and effective. I'll tell you right off the bat.
Yeah.
Magic's great. I am not the guy that wants to know how it works.
Sure.
Don't – not that I don't care. I just really appreciate the amount of work that goes behind even, you know, some
you,
of, some
you,
of the
– You appreciate the meal that's being prepared.
I appreciate it. I don't need to know. Yes, I get the fact that just some of the simple card – simple, bad word – you make it look very simple, but you know, simply the sleight of hand.
Sure.
I know how many years goes into a teller, a friend of mine. So I've had these conversations to some degree with him. But then I've also had to work with David Copperfield. Very different kind of thing. But what I liked about your show, and by the way, love the heck out of that show.
Thanks.
Not the magic. Magic, good. Good magic.
No,
I don't know how you get that freaking boat in that bottle.
That's not the point, yeah.
It's the self-examination, the rawness, the personal risk.
Yeah, it's a risky show.
Involved. At what point does a guy like you who has skills?
Yeah.
I mean, you're the the Grand Poobahs chose you as the close magic guys in 2 years in a row, right? It was, which has got to be a big deal. You don't get that just being a slouch.
In that world, sure.
But so here's a guy who's really good with the tricks. And you could do that. And you could build you could have the stage at the Rio.
Mm-hmm.
Or probably anywhere else that you wanted to. But you decide to do something completely different.
Right.
And now for something totally different, and build something personal, small, to the point of almost being uncomfortable as an audience member.
Yep.
It's a little too close to you,
and
it's a little too close to everybody else.
Yes.
You know, I do stage shows. I don't like playing anything under about 3,000 seats because it starts feeling a little odd, energy-wise.
Right.
You choose a broom closet.
Yes.
It's a beautiful broom closet.
Yeah.
What the heck?
That's a good question. The what the heck part. You could have just said what the heck, and I would have probably understood.
I needed to take up some time.
No, I understand.
But we've never. You and I have never had a conversation.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's the first time. But I understand your sentiment, and I understand the parallels that you would see in your work and mine culturally. And I think it boils down to wanting to break a thing, and looking at looking at being a magician and what that meant and what that is in the world right now.
What is it?
And, well, I mean, if you define it, it depends on how you define it. Socially, there's a lot of stigmas attached to being a magician. Magicians are losers or loners who were awkward, and they use magic to kind of communicate that way. And Job, I think, from Arrested Development, is what most people have in mind, and most portrayals of magicians are, it's the comic relief. It's they're the loser in the show. They're the person who picks up magic is the geek, or he's trying to do it to pick up women. And it's not necessarily wrong. It's magician's fault for taking it.
Because what you're talking about is a classic clown character. You're talking about a clown.
Yeah, but that's not a magician's intention. They don't think. I mean, magicians now, they're also try to be funny, and they're not as funny as comedians. So it's a really, they've positioned themselves culturally as being like these pariahs. And magic as a not just as a performative craft, but as like a concept has been around for thousands of years, and the magician used to be like the king's, consultant and alchemists and wizards and things that even archetypally are very powerful have been reduced to tricks that you do for kids, and a guy has a comic book collection and he has his magic book collection, and those two things might be synonymous. And for me, I'm interested with the concepts that go with magic and the space that it can create of unknowingness and uncertainty. And I think that's a powerful tool of being able to create a space of absolute uncertainty. And in that space, you can present an idea, because if everyone is a status quo of like everyone has no idea what's happening and we're in a white space that no one knows anything, what conversation can be started? What biases are gone because of that? And so magic to me has always had a lot of power in theory, but how you do that in practice is totally different. And for me, I've never been comfortable being being a magician with the way that the world reflects back, like, and what that means. And so this show that I'm doing is primarily about identity, and it's about you know, how you think you are and how others see you, and those two things may not be the same thing. They may not line up, and having to deal with that, and especially since this was, you know, ostensibly my first big solo show, and I'm putting myself in the, you know, public eye for the first time by myself in a way that I'm like, okay, here I am. What will you call me at the end of the day? What will you call all of this? What will this show be? What will I be after this? And it's partly defined by my choices, but it's also partly defined by what you choose to call me afterwards, and what you choose to say that I did and do for a living or as a craft or whatever. So, I don't know if I answered your question.
We're getting there. We're getting to intent. You know, yeah. When did you decide there is something more, there is something else
well,
that you want to ask? You're asking questions of yourself,
you
or
know,
you're asking...
I got into... I would say it's... The intent came before... Like, I didn't have a light switch moment. I always felt like the things that I recognized in magic as a performative craft were valuable to the world, and I've always felt that, but I didn't know how to do it. My vision of what I saw potential in, I couldn't, and I don't mean just technically, I mean the language didn't even exist to communicate the way that I felt when I saw magic, or the way that, you know, some people see a rainbow, you know, or something. Like, I just felt it. And so it was about translating that to the world and the way I see it and what it can be and what it should be, as opposed to what it is and what we know it to be. And so that intent has always been there, but I've been striving to do this show or a version of whatever this is probably my entire life, in terms of it's been in me of like you know, this can matter. This is what you should feel when you feel a moment of wonder and astonishment. It should wreck you. There should be no reaction, almost. Like, it's not entertainment, it's not fun, it's I don't understand what's happening right now. And the step that I think that if a magician is successful on that level, I think most magicians do tricks. They don't inspire real awe or wonder in the world. The next step is inserting an idea in that moment of wonder that allows them to ground themselves, but with something more than what they had a second ago. So
that requires vulnerability, doesn't it? So putting the audience as well as kind of yourself at the same time into a place of vulnerability allows for almost infecting them with an idea or a thought or a question.
That is right. And that's why that I reluctantly talk about myself in this show a little bit, to allow for that, as Oprah would say.
The coughing, by the way, is from Derek's French friend. Yes. Just so I want to throw that in. We can't actually talk and cough at the same time. it's L.A. smog. You're not used to the smog. Sorry about the area. Hey, it's loud.
What was the question? You just coughed through me off.
No, we were talking about the vulnerability.
Oh, right. As Oprah would say, you got to give them a piece of yourself, you know? And so I feel like you have to open up and be honest and have real humility and humanity if you expect your audience to deliver that back to you.
Is that something that you have always put in your shows, though, a sense of kind of vulnerability? You have this persona, which I'm assuming is simply you.
Yeah.
Which is that you don't play high energy.
Right.
You know, you're kind of semi-deadpan, and because of that vulnerable.
It is just me.
So do you think, has that always been something that people reacted to in the shows? And
yeah, I mean, I have to be okay with it being off-putting. I mean, I have always fought against character, against acting, against playing moments that aren't real. Authenticity is the number one thing to me of is this an authentic moment or a thing or a gesture or an object? Is it real? And doing it real and being authentic are the most important things to me. The paradox is that I've chosen a vocation that is all about deception. And so this has been kind of the crux of figuring out how to make these two things coexist of
Because you get that they're opposites, right?
They're the complete opposite.
You want to lie and tell the truth.
Yeah.
You want people to believe and disbelieve.
Yeah.
And you want to connect, but then also, by the art of the con, disconnect.
Yeah, and so I've made a very clear choice to be honest about my deception or deceitfulness. And like in the show, you watch the show, I say in the very beginning, everything you're about to hear is true. But I realize because of who I am, you won't believe me. And that's the show, is that like everything I say is true and everything we're going to be doing is the truth and talking about. And I still have people come up to me afterwards like, was that story you told about your mom true? I'm like, yeah, that's true. That's why I started the show with everything I say is true. Everything in that show is true. And it becomes very difficult. But in that struggle is the drama of like what you would get in theater. Normally you have two actors on stage and there's a dramatic moment. One of them wants something, the other one wants something else, and they argue.
Thus is the base of all drama.
Sure. So, but that doesn't exist, or that it does exist in bad magic, where like, oh, the guy's chained up, is the saw going to cut him in half or something like that? And that worked for a time, but like that's
still works for some.
Still works for some, but not for, it's not interesting to me, and I don't, it's fake. It's not authentic, and it's not really saying anything or doing anything. It's theatrical. It's theatrics. But can you create that conflict within another human being and them be their own antagonist and protagonist is what I think a good, creating a conflict for someone in that way, it's like, and just leaving them with it and walking away, that's more of what I'm interested in. So like you having a debate with yourself of what whether – that was me – whether or not what you just saw was real is a conflict, and you're now both – you're both sides of it reasoning with yourself. And I take the high road in terms of like if I say something, I want it to be truthful. I'm fully aware that it's a paradox, and that's part of the magic show. Part of it is that cannot be happening. Well, it just happened. Well, it did. It's not possible. And you take on both roles in that regard. Does that make any sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
One of the things that's so that I think a lot about in performing.
Mm-hmm.
These days, I mean, I had a weird path. I had a theater degree.
Wait, can you hold that thought?
Yeah.
So every person I know who I'm like, you know, Alton has a live show. The next follow-up question is, how? And so that's like amazing to me. As someone – like the form of a magic show is – it's one thing to break it and go like, I'm going to do this differently than it's ever been done before.
Mm-hmm.
But like
to blow it out.
And break the expectations. Break walls, people have expectations. And so for me, it's breaking expectations of like, oh, this isn't what I expected. And so there's like a form of what you have there to already work with.
Mm-hmm.
But for you, that doesn't exist. Like there's no – it's not like, oh, I saw a live cooking show over at the Pantages. Is his anything like that? Well, no. It doesn't exist.
I do a culinary variety show.
I know. How? Yeah. Did that like
– Because nobody was doing it. I looked around and said, gee, you know, I really like live performing and nobody's ever done like a traveling variety show. I'm going to do that because I'm not sure that I can.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so
– was that what appealed to you, that you weren't sure that it would work?
Part of it. Part of that is a huge thing. Saying – to me as a performer, a lot of it's like, okay, I got this skill set. I know I can do this and this, but I don't know if I can do this. And it's like when I done shows where I did big demos and you know, big theaters, and that's all fine and good. But then when you put together a variety show, it's like, well, you're going to do a variety show. You have to have music. You have to sing. Yeah. You have to do songs. I was like, oh, crap. I guess I better learn how to play guitar and write songs.
Wow.
So it was daring myself.
Right.
You know, for me, the juice has always been, can I do that? I don't know. And I, unfortunately, always put more stock in being original than good. If I can be original and be good, great.
Yeah.
But original and authentic to myself first and foremost. And if I can do that in such a way where I can tap something into an audience. Look, I'm not daring them to look at their identities. I'm not doing anything that is really – a lasting penetration. But if I can get a bunch of people to come to a theater and really have a good time for 2.5 hours, then I'll take that.
Yeah,
I'll take
but
that.
Doing that with food is an impressive.
Yeah, but if people look and say, well, how much time does he actually spend touching food in this? You know, my first tour show, God, this is becoming about me now. How did you do that? You know, yes, we built a contraption out of office water cooler bottles that shot two different kinds of fire extinguishers at each other, one with CO2, one with highly pressurized chocolate cream that made a gallon of carbonated ice cream in 10 seconds. Okay. That was part of the show. Yeah. You know, it's not like I'm cooking. We did cook pizzas in a gigantic easy bake oven, 8 feet tall, wow. 12 feet long, that punched out 1,026,000 lumens of light and looked like a star when it came on. So things like that. But that's all about just like, nobody's done this. I want to do this. I want to do something that hasn't been done and see if I can make it work. Right. And then if it works, I'll roll with it.
Right.
And carve out so that when people say, well, geez, what the heck could you do for 2.5 hours? And then if I can just get them to come, and then they'll talk about it and they'll move on. But I would say when I've told people about your show, they're like, oh, it's a magic show. I'm like, no. It is a one-man memoir with illustrative illusions. Yeah. Is actually the way I put it. Because I'm like, it's not about the brick on the table.
No.
It's about... That becomes subtext.
Well, I mean, the show.
Not that the thing on the brick's not
great.
No,
don't get me wrong. I get
it's
it. It's
great.
The whole thing is learning the language of what you should call a thing. You know, that's kind of what the show's about.
Well, that's
about.
What the show is about. What do you call a thing?
What do you call a thing? And people are the thing, and they're the other half of the show. And that's true, not just in this show. That's true in every show. They are the other half of the experience. So the show is about them as much as it is about me. And I use any stories I tell about myself are an access point to yourself. That's
bingo.
All it is.
It's an invitation.
Yeah.
In a way. But you know what you're tapping into, and a lot of what I'm interested in this forum is the changing nature of narrative itself.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, back in your world, I can watch Teller do that whole act with the balloon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not looking for threads. I assume there's a thread. It just doesn't matter to me. But I'm
really...
They say
it at the beginning of that piece.
Exactly.
There's a piece with
but
the
even
thread.
Before, I didn't know that. I like the trick better now.
Yeah.
But to me, it's really about the way he portrays a relationship with the balloon. It's the story, the narrative of it. You know, and what those guys have been so great at is by telling you how they do the trick.
Sure.
Make the trick even more amazing.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think that what makes your... If you just did your tricks, if you just came out and did the pieces, I don't know what you call them in your world, the bits, what do you call them?
We'll,
a trick.
We'll say tricks.
If you just came out and did the tricks.
Sure.
I'd say, wow, guy's got some really good sleight of hand, great with cards.
Sure.
But it wouldn't have a lasting
effect on me. It's not about you at that point,
Well, exactly. It's not about me. And you manage by making it about you, slightly uncomfortably, I might add.
Yes.
And I don't know if you cultivate that discomfort or if it's 100% honest still after this many performances. It resonates.
Yeah.
That feeling of slight, I'm not 100% at home. I'm not slick.
I will never be comfortable with it because it's such an unnatural. Like if you work from a place of real authenticity of like fighting for the truth of the moment or whatever, this has all been manufactured. You know, this is you're sitting in the dark facing the same direction towards me with a light on me, and I'm talking. That is an unnatural condition in this world, and so like there's always in the back of my head. Like fighting for the reality of it, which is you're people in a room and I'm here and we're here and we're going to talk and I'm going to say things, but there's always but you're all facing the same way looking at me. And as long as like that's a part of it and it's, I will never be fully comfortable with being on stage in that regard.
Since one of the things that I get that 100%, you change the relationship that you have with the audience because of what you do is mm-hmm. different from what most people in your trade have. the presentational relationship with the audience,
right?
Which I would have with if I went down and saw the Illusionist show. Okay, that's going to be me being presented to. I'm going to watch a thing. And you know what? The thing may be pretty slick. Wow, that's a slick thing. Okay, but because you're not doing that, and because you're inviting people to really. I don't know if look at themselves is potentially the correct word or term.
Or how do you look at things? Even that question of,
To question this idea of perception must occasionally result in you getting responses to things that you don't expect. Meaning that everything from applause to just the general vibe that you get from an audience in that space has got to be a little bit odd and a little bit different because you're – you're stirring the pot in a different direction.
Yeah, I've had this discussion a lot lately. We were talking about it on the drive over here about there are things in the show that are genuinely unnerving that they're happening. And I only bring a couple people up on stage each night, but one of the pieces is the person on the let's say reaction. Is dependent on the person who's brought up emoting and reacting to it. And if they are a robot, I don't have in place, which in traditional magic shows would probably be the case, cues or gestures or words or things that would spark a reaction from the audience as like ta-da is a good example. Ta-da, you know, like that's – now I know the trick has happened, and I know that I'm supposed to clap.
And yet you do.
I do in some places. I don't have a ta-da, but I have a it's over. But this, the letter piece. If the person doesn't like, that's real every night. And if this person doesn't really have a reaction to what's happening on stage because they're nervous, they're in front of strangers and people don't know how to be on stage. I acknowledge all those things and I don't embarrass anyone. But it's not just a trick. It's a real thing. Like it's embarrassing. It's uncomfortable for some people. And if they don't react to it, I send them back to their seat and move on to the next thing. And, I fight with myself of, do I have a safety net that it's like it all worked out fine. They're just a little emotional right now and they can't respond, but everything worked out great. Or just let them stew in the reality of the situation and let that's a real reaction. Like not reacting is a reaction. And so do I let the authenticity of the moment that's how that happens and live it out? Or do we bring some show business back into it and, you know, razzle dazzle and change cues and stuff?
I asked myself, because when I left the show the first time, I parts of it kept playing over and over in my head. And I'm sure that people come to you all the time and talk to you about what they feel is meaningful about the show or what they really like about the show. There is something about being asked to stand up as a group and kind of admit publicly to the identity you have chosen, because there are no accidents in that.
There are no accidents in that.
And I watched only partially. I think the first time I saw the show, I was trying to figure it out.
Sure.
And then the second time I realized that the real gift of this, forget that there's a trick and watch people come to terms with this, you know, myself included. And I was genuinely touched by some of the reactions, because it's not that you were guessing what was on the card or knowing that it was the public affirmation almost of what I see myself as. And that's where your whole thing of cracking open this idea of identity is, as you know, important because it's the crux of the show. Yeah. It's the grand finale of the show, actually.
Sure. I mean, there's an interesting, again, it's part of the show of like the paradox of I'm having you flatten yourself to be one thing before you even walk in the door. I'm having you decide who you are. So before you even walk in, you have the question of who am I? in this world.
You're walking in the door with this thing already having
literally,
happened.
Literally, yeah.
It's a semi-crisis. It's an eensy-beensy mini-crisis standing in front of that board.
Yeah.
And you know how overwhelming it is because you know how many are up there.
It is a lot of – how does the world see you? How do you see yourself? How – what – here's your chance. You have to identify yourself. What are you going to call yourself? And then making that the hero moment, but it also is the hero moment with a twist in that you're not. You're more than that. Like, you're more than one thing. So whatever you've chosen, that's great that that's how you like to be seen in this world, but let's unpack that. And you're actually also this and this and this and this, but we've taught ourselves that you can only be one thing. And that's you know, hopefully the lesson of the show is that, like, and when it's unresolvable, but it is at least being aware that we are all more than one thing, and we can be more than one thing, but our simplistic language only allows us to communicate as if we're one thing. You know, what do you put on a bank loan?
What goes on the bank loan?
You know,
card?
And that is the show. That question, the first question you asked, is the show. It's, you know, what would you write on if you had to get a bank loan? What would you say your occupation is or who you are in this world? The crisis of that question is the show, you know.
You've mentioned, and I read one interview with you, where you brought up a couple of interviews. I hate referencing other interviews, but you mentioned made reference to the idea of performance art, and you even mentioned he died last year.
Oh, Chris Burden.
Chris Burden, who yeah. I thought there are probably 10 of us that remember.
Sure,
Chris Burden and art that. I used to get in fights with people about the fact that, to me, his art was perhaps the most purest art that I had ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
Because what is more challenging as an artist, letting somebody shoot you.
Yeah.
Or letting yourself be crucified onto a Volkswagen yeah. Beetle. These are all things that are make us confront incredibly uncomfortable things on ourselves, yeah. much less the concept of an artist. Because that changes the whole meaning of what art is. And you yeah. were speaking in reference specifically to David Blaine and the whole ice thing. And you were talking about how Burton would have –
sure.
he would have treated that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the fact that Blaine doesn't – it's interesting. You said if he had a curatorial staff kind of working the story for him, that it would be – he'd be like the world's greatest performance art. Do you now consider yourself more a performance artist
no.
or a magician, or does it freaking matter? It
doesn't matter. Okay, I really, really cared. I really cared about, and that's, and in doing this show, I realized it doesn't matter.
You cared about being an artist?
Yeah, the way that the world puts a certain gravitas with the word artist, you want to be an artist. You know, you certainly don't want to be a, you know, if it's between entertainer and an artist, you're like, well, I'm an artist. But I stopped caring because I realized it's about the work and it's about the what you're doing and what you're saying. And the words are really malleable and they mean such a different thing to me than it does to you. I mean, when I say artist and you might think of Chris Burden, you and I might be on the same page, but when I say art or artist to someone else, it's like saying magic. I'm not sure what image is conjured up in your head.
To me, artist is more about the reason you do a thing than the thing you do.
Say it again.
Being an artist is more about why you do the thing more than the thing
100%
itself.
Intention is everything.
The intention for a long time in my own career, I resented the what I thought of as the pretension mm-hmm. of art,
yeah.
air quotes I'm making, of being an artist. Because yeah. I knew artists who were real artists, as in, there, I have made this.
No,
now
right.
somebody is going to give me $800,000 for that. And that's when I realized, oh, I know a couple of fine artists who are in fact craftsmen and business people.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And not necessarily artists, because art is more about why you do it.
Yeah.
So you're more than a magician now. You are an artist because of the intent.
Yeah. The show leaks into performance art and artistry because of my intent and what I want to say and do with the show. And it's certainly more than the craft of magic. Like, I don't believe, you know, magic is inherently an art form. I don't know. Anything is inherently an art form. It's the artist.
You make it that way.
Yeah, the artist. It's Duchamp. I don't believe in art. I believe in artists.
In artists.
You know, and I believe that is absolutely true. And you know, so, but I'm hesitant to to say I'm a performance artist over a magician or vice versa, because I think the importance is in being both. Like, I think that maintaining a duality between what you do, performance art, magic, right, whatever, like, and I am not one of those things. I am all of those things, and I think that it's about the work. I have the one I take. If someone says you're a writer, I'm hesitant to call myself a writer ever, because I know writers and they sit down and write. Just the way that, like, I can play the guitar, I would never call myself a guitarist ever. And so I
same here, buddy. Same
so,
here.
Yeah. So, like, to say you're a writer, I know writers, and they sit down and they wake up and they write, and then they go to bed and they wake up the next day. They're writers. Performance artist, I don't know. I mean, like, I make things with intentions that are bigger than I talk about gestures and the thing and metaphor, and I work in allegory and these things. So yeah, okay, that's in the world of art. Magic, certainly, I've done that my whole life technically, and so out of all of them, I'm the most of that is consumed time wise. That has consumed the most of my life.
Well, and if you weren't good at it, if you weren't good at that, the rest of it wouldn't really matter.
No, and I think that's what's important is that, like, I'm much more interested in transforming a thing that people expect and think they understand and having them see it in a new way that's beautiful, as opposed to being another thing. You know, I feel like, well, this show is important because it's a magical show and there's magic in it and it's by a magician, but it's unlike anything you've ever seen. If I said there's a performance art show you got to see, you wouldn't even know what to expect. But because people often, I have not once said this is a magic show, like in print or anything, people call it a magic show because I have a magic background. And so you allow them to go, it's a magic show. And then they go and see it and they're like, that was not a magic show. But because of that preconceived notion, that's part of the narrative. Like, me sure. Understanding that they're thinking they're going to see a magic show is part of the show. Which is a weird way to think about that.
No, but I get it.
It's important, though.
Yeah,
like,
it is.
Like, you think you're going to come see an elephant. You're not going to come see an elephant.
You're not going to see an elephant.
But I know that you're going to think you're seeing one. So that's been important in terms of how I frame it, I guess.
You might not have coined this term. I had not heard it, okay. Which was service entertainment.
I did not coin that term. That is a term.
Okay, I don't know.
People use
service entertainment. You're talking about differentiating what you were doing from service entertainment, which I assume means give me $5, I'll show you a trick. Or is that what service entertainment is?
In a sense, yes. But I think that in a larger scheme, I think magic has become a form of service entertainment, in that the economy and the commerce of it and the world has defined the work in a lot of ways. I remember, speaking of Teller, Teller said something to me, and he probably doesn't remember saying this, at least not to me. A friend of mine was describing a show and how proud he was that he can fit his entire show in his carry-on luggage, which is an impressive feat. Like, if you
depends on the show.
Depends on the show, but he was very, like, that he's figured out a way to just travel with the show and travel only carry on, and as a working workhorse magician, that is a feat. That is an impressive thing. And Teller said, he goes, oh, that's really great, having all your stuff right there and being able to, like, travel carry on and put it all in your bag. That's really good that you can do that, or you can do a show. And I just went, ooh, that was like, it was, he said it in jest, so it was funny, but it was so true too, in that the sense of, and I don't even know if he meant this when he said it, but it's, you can either think about how your stuff packs into a bag, or you can think without a box at all, or a bag, or a thing, and you can just think. And we're all guilty of it. I mean, I'm sure Penn and Teller they do things because they know it'll play, you know? And so the real challenge...
They're businessmen. As are you.
Well, that's parts to be decided. I'm not very good at that because I'm very, very... I'm pretty bad about business right now in terms of I don't care. I want the work to be the work. Like, and I trust the business side would come with, if you make a good enough thing, people will pay for it. That is my extent of my business knowledge, is that, like, if you make a really good thing and it's better than everything else that's out there, people will pay for that thing, I hope.
I've never made anything for anybody but myself.
Yeah.
And if somebody wants it and likes it, then I'm going to be okay. And if not, I better find something else.
Yeah. No, that's the way to go. And magicians specifically, well, when I use the word service entertainment, that is, you know, a thing that is hard to overcome because there's not a lot of – there's no industry. There's certainly very little demand for magic in terms of – like the biggest magic industry is the commerce of magic itself, magicians selling things to one another.
To magicians.
To magicians. And, you know, I had to really fight to not think in terms of, well, what do people want? What do people like? And that is a very good way to make a living is what works, what makes
sure.
What will people like? What will people respond to? Do I have to check my luggage? That saves me $50 there. Like you start thinking in terms of the outside world as opposed to what do I want to say? What do I think? What do I believe in? And what do I want to say to people? How do I, you know, what do I want to make? And once you free yourself from any thoughts of having to worry about the commerce, then you allow yourself that freedom. To think that way, but it is extremely difficult. But I think there's absolutely a difference between service entertainment and artistry, and like a real and it's true even in Penn and Teller show. You can see the stuff that's very commercial, and then you watch Teller get up there and start to stab the shadow of a rose, and you'd be like, "This is another thing. This
whole
is
another ball of wax.
This isn't or the red ball. You know, these are silverfish. You know, are things that like are really." Poetic and beautiful, and they came from someone's soul. Like you just see it, and there's a huge, huge difference.
Well, they also affect the viewer in a very, very different way.
Yeah, of course.
And I think that most people can still recognize art, and people can still recognize poignancy if they slow down to examine it. I mean, I don't know how many times I've seen.
So optimistic of you.
Well,
to think that I mean, it's good. It's good that you believe in people that they can see that.
Maybe it's only because I'm using myself as a model, and I don't think of myself as very deep water. I mean, I'm susceptible to commerce, is anybody. But when I look around, I mean, I've gone, I don't know how many times I've seen, you know, Teller do that piece in front of a live audience, and I look around at the people around, and there is a different.
Yes, there is.
There is a difference. They may not actually be aware of it.
No.
In a cognitive, like they're going to talk about it later. But I think that while it's happening, there is still something in human beings that recognizes the difference.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well,
whether it's meaning or whether it's, I don't know.
What would be the food equivalent? Soul food? Like how? Like this?
Well, see, that's it. Here's the funny thing about. Mm-hmm. Food media mm-hmm. is that it is the ultimate prophylactic game of it's uh-huh. like when I decided to quit my job and go to culinary school, people are like, "You're freaking crazy. You've got a job, you direct commercials, you make a good living."
Yeah, yeah.
Like, no. Food media is because I'm wanting to be a better cook and I got no shows to watch and all the shows are boring. But when you think about it, it's ridiculous. You can't taste food on television. You can't taste food in a magazine. You can't taste food on a computer screen.
Yeah.
We haven't worked out the technology of lickable screens.
Yeah.
You know, we haven't reached that Willy Wonka moment yet. But it is therefore almost perfect for our age because it is food is the last great connective tissue of human beings in this day and age. We're not united by common beliefs. We're not united by religion. We're not unified by, wow, did you see the game last night? We can all sit around and talk about that. We are splintered into 100 million societies
mm-hmm.
because of the internet greatly and because of media in general. And yet the three of us have one thing in common today. We will eat or we will get hungry and eventually die.
Yeah.
Some of us can go longer than others. But the truth is it unites us. And you know what? If I cook something and we all sit down and eat it, that simple act of hospitality changes everything about who we are as people.
Yeah.
If I offer you food and you accept it,
it's a transaction.
That is a human transaction that is very, very potent stuff. So, you know, food, we absorb the planet, we absorb each other, we absorb our histories, our families, blah, blah, blah. And yet, the way that most of us absorb it now is this prophylactic experience.
That's really interesting.
I got no other than to say that we crave it. You know, anthropologists will tell you there's only two things that every people group on Earth, no matter how cosmopolitan or remote, want to do in a group. Two. One is eat. The other is laugh. Every people group on Earth want to do those two things in groups.
Wow.
So,
no, that's
there you go.
Magic is very divisive in that regard. So yeah, that is not a
magic
shared experience.
Makes us believe that there is the possibility of things beyond our understanding.
Well, you would hope.
But the thing is, I mean, once upon a time, magicians made us believe in magic, as in the occult.
Well, that's
phenomenon.
That's why it's changed the service entertainment. Because think about it now, like that doesn't exist. You don't. No. People don't go to magic shows to, you know, I need to believe in something more than my reality. I'm going to go see the latest magic show. No, it's a fun day out, or it's a good show.
And yet, if you don't worry about trying to figure out the trick, which most of us can never do anyway because we just don't think that way, what we can accept when we watch someone like you perform is that there is this whole other layer of human ability that changes the experience of what it's like to be human.
Yeah, you would hope. Yeah.
Got me.
No, I mean, well, good. It seems to be rare, and I'm looking for it myself, like in other people's work. I would love to see a magic show and leave changed and leave thinking about the world.
Has that never happened for you? And I'm not asking you to say whose magic's good and whose magic's bad.
It's not happened with a show, but it's happened with a few people. I've Seb is one of them, our French friend here. There are people who have left me changed, like because of the experience that I had, but it had nothing to do it's never happened in a show. It's never happened sitting in a theater. I've never left a theater changed because of a magic trick.
Your run, the end draws nigh. How do you feel about that? And I always, when I talk to live performers, I like to talk about, because it's like when people ask me about the end, you know, your tour's ending, you've been on the road for 8 weeks. How do you like, oh my God, I want it to be over so bad. Oh my God, I don't want it to be over because I've come to identify myself so much in that loop. How do you feel?
There's the physical component of I'm very tired. I'm glad to have some rest. But then there's the part where I feel like it's just getting good. I feel like right about the time I'm ready to figure this out, this thing, because this is exploration for me. It's not done. Like,
no,
every day it's a new thing. And I'm starting to figure it out. And, you know, several months in, I'm starting to get it. And as soon as I know what I need to do, I won't have another show. That part is a luxury, being able to do the show and figure it out. But, you know, we know we're going to open up again and do it somewhere else and hope lots of people can see it and start the process all over again. But it's bittersweet. Bittersweet, I think, is probably.
When you rebuild that show somewhere else, I assume, you're going to New York, you're going to go to
probably
New York would be the place that seems to make the most sense.
Yeah, seems to make sense.
You're going to take a break.
Yeah.
How long?
That's determined by, I think, the New York people, the people helping us figure out the right place to take it.
I asked the wrong question then.
Yeah.
How long you want to rest?
Oh, I don't need any time. A week, 2 weeks.
During which time you would do what?
I think probably should go to Europe.
Is that your default?
No, I don't have a default. That seems like a thing to do.
Well, when Derek's just like hanging around doing nothing, what's Derek doing?
Going to Europe, I guess. I guess that's a real thing now.
Now it's a thing.
Usually go to Paris or go to Spain or you know, try Italy.
How long has it been since you've been to Europe?
Spain was the last one. No, almost like a year and a half, 2 years, something like that.
So you need to book a trip.
Yeah, yeah. And it's usually not a working trip, but it's usually a lot of the same, talking to the same people and seeing the same friends. It's nice to not have to go be on a stage every night for a while, at least, you know. But that's me. And that's how I know I'm different is I know lots of friends who crave the stage and love the applause and love the stage and love doing their show. And that's great. That's just not for me what the – like, I have a problem where I could do a show once and I'll be like, well, that's done and move on. Or it's like, let's make this right. But it's one or the other. It's not like
let's
this
make
is
this
it.
This right. That's, I it's like putting. I don't golf, but live performing is my golf now. And it's like every night it's like, okay, I'm going to go out and I'm going to do this. And maybe tonight it's, you know, it's 2,500 people or it's 5,000 people, whatever the house is. And you gauge the house within the first few moments and you figure out, am I going this way? Am I going this way? How do I treat the volunteers that come up? How, and like, I mean, my volunteers are, nobody's planted. Everything just happens. And every night.
Do people suspect plants?
Yeah. In a lot of cities they do because when people start kind of taking over the show and it becomes really, really funny, which it very often does, especially in houses where there's a bar. And they're up there for quite a while with me and it can get really crazy. People will be like, oh, that was obviously a plant. I'm like, no. I say, if it was a plant, do you have any idea how boring this would be for me?
Yeah.
Because I know every cue. I know every mill. I know every angle that can be played on every cue. But the two things that I don't know is both of the acts that I have, act one and act two, because we have an intermission. There's a volunteer.
Yeah.
And that volunteer's up there with me half an hour sometimes.
Wow.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Not very often. Usually it's a little less than that. But and what's going to happen during that time? No freaking idea.
Yeah.
And depending on the house, the town, the region, the acoustics, you know, the only thing that I control is in one act, I always pick a guy, and in another act, I always pick a girl, you
sure.
know, because I just how I do things. But it would be boring. It would be beyond boring
yeah.
for me. But I get so fixated on getting one particular thing right in the show that I can have a couple of curtain calls, standing ovation, and it actually won't mean anything to me because I'm not thinking about that anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, like, yeah, okay, they're happy. Great. But there was this point at blah, 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 where, you know, I lost this and I didn't maximize that. And then you start fixating and,
yeah.
and then it starts to eat you and then you're not having fun anymore.
No, yeah.
That happens to me at least.
That happens to me from time to time. And I need to remind myself or have someone around me remind me that I'm very fortunate to do what I do. And so the perfectionist, not everyone is a perfectionist. And so, like, I realize how it makes those around you who are supportive, like the stagehands or the stage manager or friends or consultants, whatever. And the more it's like, it makes them feel bad. It wears on them. So I try to avoid that, but it's really hard to.
When you're traveling on rock and roll buses and playing a different theater every town, you realize that you are the father. So to speak, and that if you start to crash out,
yeah.
Everybody goes down around
that's,
you, and
it's a lot of responsibility.
It is. It can be rewarding,
yeah.
But you have to make it less and less about yourself. I'll tell you that. That's for sure. But you already know that. We're now talking about the intricacies of long-term stage performance that have flummoxed mankind for yeah. a really, really long time.
Yeah.
And you're doomed. There's devils on both sides of the equation.
Yeah. But the end of it is you're really lucky to have a
yeah.
job where people come out to see you and,
yeah.
and like what you do.
Yeah.
And that's reminding yourself of that is challenging sometimes. And no one else often reminds you because their job is to do whatever their job is. It's not remind you of that thing. So,
but not everybody can be a rulettista.
Not everyone can. That's for sure.
Are there ever nights where something doesn't work right?
Sure.
You ever mess up a trick?
I've had the last week I had apparently a virus that moved its way into my inner ear and I had a vertigo situation where I felt like I was on a boat,
holy
which
smokes.
I've never had before. And I literally felt like I was on the deck of a ship.
Everything
was wobbly, and they had to close the curtain on me at one point because I couldn't focus enough to continue. I didn't even know I wasn't talking. It was like so bad, and had paramedic look at me, and I was fine. Had them open the curtain, restarted the show, but boy, that's like a nightmare on stage of them having to actually shut curtains on you because, I mean, that's a movie horror moment of like, this is a worst dream come true. And you have, you know, my job is always to be honest with them of like, what's happening of like, it was a little medical situation, but we're back. You know, let's continue. And all you want to do is go home and curl up with your blanket and cry. And you know, but you can't. You have to do your
the show must go
the
on.
The show must go on, and it does. And then I had to do another show. It was a double header that day. So
doing a double header sick. The worst hell that I know was being a bad sinus infection and having two sold out shows at the Pentagis here during my last tour on a Saturday. And, you know, I have to sing and I have to blah, blah, blah. And it was like all you can do is just
forget it.
Freaking do it.
Did you do drugs? Do you, like not drugs like DayQuil and stuff? Or you do like
just like enough to get by because it throws off your timing. And some things dry you up too much to talk. And if you're singing, you've got a dry mouth. Oh, you can't do that. You're better up just sucking it up and you know and hoping to God that something doesn't pour out of the front of your face you know when you're doing it but you know you just do it. So you're going to take a break, you're going to go to Europe, and then you're going to remount the show in New York, and everybody in the world's going to come see it. Then you're going to do what?
I hope so.
And then you're going to do what?
You know, I'm figuring
out. Is there when people say, Derek, what do you want to do next?
I feel like this is the beginning of a dialogue. I feel like this show is like the first line of a paragraph, you know, and continuing whatever this paragraph is what's important. I don't have like an agenda of what is next in terms of like my own creation, like
because people expect that of us, you know, of adults.
Do they?
Yeah, they do.
I you know, I'll always probably do live shows of some sort because I feel like. There's no replacement for that, and I feel like that any TV is an advertisement for a live show. Like for me, I've written a TV show now and a movie, and those are like sort of being made. So that's
say with a shrug.
Well, like, it's Hollywood until something's
until it's done. Yeah, until the check's clear.
Until the check's clear, and people are watching it. I don't count anything. And so I found those platform is not as rewarding because I have no control. Basically, I'm left to other people's devices. So, really, for me, the most fulfilling thing is live theater and live events and things like that. Books or writing things that are under my control.
Do you feel you're a writer now?
No, not at all. I haven't written anything.
You kind of have, though.
Well,
just said to me that you'd written a TV show and a movie. Yeah, you just said that.
You haven't read them.
Well, they don't exist or not exist because I haven't read.
That's a good example of like I think that like to be a writer like that is the end of your process. Like that is your like I have a writer friend who writes. He's a playwright and he writes film and television, and he hands over a script and his job is done, and he lets them go off and either do it or not do it, and he does the plays for himself, and he does the TV and film to pay the bills and stuff. But he doesn't care. It's like okay, you're going to make it. You're not going to make it. Hope you make it. You know, everyone. But the writing part is, and for me, whatever the form is the final thing. So if I wanted to make a film, like film writing is a step to that, but that is on the way to the end destination. You know, it's part of a very large process. And if I were a writer, I guess I would write, and that would be the end of it. A book is probably the best example of like a thing I might do someday that I could go, I'm a writer now. I've written a book, but everything else is just yet to be seen.
I reread The Great Gatsby every year. Number one, it's not that long. Number two, it's freaking magnificent. And number three, if you think you're a writer, it'll shut you the hell up.
Oh, yeah.
Because, and I think you need to read things that humble you to believe, you know what, all that things people are telling you. Keep to your own counsel on that stuff. So you must do that though as a magician.
There's only been a few people who've absolutely destroyed me. But it's few and far between, and it's been so long, and I've been friends with them for so long now that it feels like home. But like, it's a new world out there in terms of the magic landscape of intention is really different, because now it used to be in my generation and certainly the generation before mine, where if you were a magician, you performed magic for people live, live. That doesn't exist anymore. People like live magic shows exist, but the kids aren't pursuing that as the end game. They're pursuing a new model of you do a thing on your YouTube account and perform for yourself on a video screen and then get a lot of likes and a lot of views and then hope that turns into a thing. Now, what we're seeing is that, like, these guys who get success doing that then are forced into doing it publicly in front of people, and it doesn't work out as well as it could have if they had their chops, you know, if they were ready to go. But, like, you know, the guys I looked up to, we looked up to, they perform for people for real, and it's a whole nother ball game. You're a theater guy. It's a different world than actually. Now celebrity is important, you know. And Blaine set the model of this. So you become famous first, and then do a live show. And
also known as the Peter Frampton model, you know, you come out with a gigantic live album and then actually do the show.
Yeah. it's a similar thing though. It's like, imagine, you know, being, you know, I guess like DJs are probably the best example. These guys are, you know, they own Macs and they're good at sampling songs together and then they become famous. Yeah. But imagine if someone actually called them a musician, like, you know, and said, like, you have to go out and play an instrument, like do a, it's like, well, that's not what I do. I do what you've seen me do. And they can do it successfully live. Like, DJs can have a career doing live performance. But a magician who is internet famous or became well known based on what they've grown up doing then has to go do a show. It's a very difficult transition for them. And the default seems to be comedy, which is really tragic that, like, magicians think they need to be funny, because of the circumstance. Like, it's the best way to affect a lot of people.
Well, there are comedians that do magic, and but they're really comedians.
Sure.
And are good.
Amazing Jonathan, or someone like that. You know?
But when you're a magician and you're starting to do comedy to fill, what the gaps?
Well, it's a substitution for absolute wonder. Like, I go to have my mind blown, you know, and I don't go, but, like, that's why that's what it should be, is, and that's why Blaine does it right on, like, TV and stuff, is you watch a guy blowing people's minds, and David's really like that. He'll really just do a trick for you, and it'll be impressive, and that's it. There's nothing else added on top of it. That is a pure form of what a magician, at least archetypally, should be. But then there's the new alternative magician of, like, wanting to also be funny and also be humorous. Now, your show should be good, but if you have a live show, it should be funny, and if you want to have humor, but it certainly shouldn't be the thrust of the show if you're calling yourself a magician.
Laughter does not replace mind blown.
I don't think so. Well, I think it's a different thing. Like, sure. I know plenty. Patton Oswalt said I was having a crisis of being a magician. I was about 25 years old. And I was really struggling with doing magic and being a magician professionally. And I had lunch with Patton Oswalt, and he was giving me some professional advice because it was our life advice of, like, what's your problem? Because we'd done some shows together and stuff, and I was the magic act on this show. And it was really a problem for me of being this magician. And he had the greatest advice, and I don't even know if he remembers it, but he told me, because I was saying, maybe I'll just become a comic. Like, maybe I'll just be maybe I'll be a comedian because I'm funny. Like, people, like, I have rapport. I can write off my own material, and I'm fine in front of people on stage. Comedy seems
to
be
that.
Maybe that would be a more fulfilling approach for me. And Patton said, you know, the world doesn't need another comic. The world also doesn't need another magician. The world needs whatever you haven't become yet. And I was like, I don't know what that means, but that is the best advice. Like, I don't even know. Like, I know what it means, but it was so Yoda-like and so wise of, like, the world needs what you haven't become yet. And if you look at my show, it's actually pretty appropriate advice of, like, what is this guy? What does he do? I don't know. There's no word for what he does yet, but there should be, you know? And so that's been a driving force. That's, you know, I don't know if that really drove me, but that was really good advice.
Well, if it didn't, it should have.
Yeah, it's
because
good.
Because most of us haven't had pearls like that dropped in front of us, at least not that we recognized.
Yeah. Yeah. So I stayed true to myself and just kept fighting the fight. And I stuck with magic reluctantly, despite the world telling me it's not worth it. And now it's sort of looking like it's might be something that's worth pursuing.
This might work out for you.
It might be all right.
Derek, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Alton.
All right, listeners, this is the time in the podcast that we call the cocktail query time because we're having cocktails. Cheers, Sarah. Sarah, cheers. Cheers.
Of course.
Boom. And we're answering queries. So it's cocktail query time. I'm here with my director of digital ops, Dodo.
Hello.
Sarah DeHeer, who has been harvesting questions from the interwebs, from our various social platforms, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and the like. And what you got for me this week?
I think we're going to go back to basics here today. I like this question because, especially with all of the holidays coming up, and in general, it's a good question. Tracy C. from Facebook asks, best online distributors for good quality spices?
Well, anybody that's ever watched Good Eats or read any of my online posts about things, I'm a huge believer in buying spices online because spices need to be replaced regularly, especially, I mean, if they're ground. Whole spices, of course, will last longer. But most of the stuff that you can find at the Mega Mart, even really good Mega Marts, tends to be old before it even gets on the shelves. and the second that they age, they lose their – there's like a time bomb. They lose those essential oils, those aromatic compounds. So I think that it's a beautiful thing to buy online because they're lightweight. They're easy to ship. And very rarely – there aren't too many ground spices that you would mistake for rice. And never mind. I'm a big fan of the Spice House. In Evansville, Illinois.
Okay.
They were originally kind of an offshoot of Pinsies. I don't find the quality of Pinsies is quite as good as I'd like it to be. So I buy everything from the Spice House. And I order a whole new set of spices about every 6 months.
And you don't buy in bulk?
I do not buy in bulk because there are some things I go through too slowly. I mean, even spices that I really love, like cumin or Saigon cinnamon or sumac, you don't go through them that fast. I mean, we're not like doing lines of sumac over here, you know?
What do you go through fast?
Well, I don't go through anything fast enough to order in bulk.
Okay.
I mow through a lot of nutmeg. I like a nutmeg.
That's because you put them in your pocket and then
lose them. Yeah. You know where I find them? I find them in the washer. I find them in the dryer. Actually, I find my nutmegs in the dryer most of the time. So I buy small amounts of everything, even things like Herbe de Provence, which I like to mix myself. So I'll get everything that goes in Herbe de Provence or Zatar, which is a favorite herb mixture. Herb and spice and seeds, technically, sesame seeds. I will buy just the stuff that goes together to do that. And I'll make kits of spices. I don't know for those of you that don't know, Sarah photographed my book, Everyday Cook. And you remember when we did the Thai iced tea?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's literally like a kit of spices that I keep together because I use most of them specifically to make Thai iced tea, which I'm addicted to. And so I'll make up little kits. Like if I'm making za'atar or whatever, I'll have just the stuff that goes in that I keep together. That way I can kind of monitor the levels of everything.
So many people will complain that, you know, you call for whole spices and then you're like, I don't have time. I don't have a grinder. You know, I don't want to toast them. I mean, what?
Well, here's the thing. It sounds
time consuming.
It sounds time consuming. But for the amount of flavor that you get, is it that time consuming?
Well, I don't think if someone hasn't done it, I don't think they know.
Well, you know what? If you're making you're making your own garam masala, which is a completely rewarding and wonderful thing to do because it makes the house smell great. If you're really going to kind of tackle even something as simple as a chicken tikka masala or a turkey tikka masala like in Everyday Cook, you're so much better off toasting those spices yourself. And look, you get yourself a $20 coffee grinder, blade-style coffee grinder, and you toast your spices. You grind them up in there. Keep one just for spices because it makes coffee taste funky. And you'd be surprised how much you get out of that. Anyway, so the point is, buy spices on a regular basis. Figure out the ones you really like and take the time, at least occasionally, to toast them and grind them yourself because, you know, spices are relatively simple and need I point out, calorie-free way of getting a lot of flavor and power into food. You and I know this full well. We were talking about this the other day. We were talking about the fried chicken that Federal Donuts sells
in Philadelphia.
Life-changing.
Fried chicken.
And the only reason that that fried chicken is so great is because they toss it in za'atar, which is a Middle Eastern mixture that contains everything from oregano to sesame seeds and typically sumac, although not everybody uses that. So a little goes a long way. It makes a seriously big difference in a lot of different foods. Anyway, that's all I got to say about that.
All right, moving on. This is a very popular question we get on Twitter a lot. And even though, I will say this, you do get this question a great deal, but whether people watch Good Eats or they haven't, time has obviously passed, and I think that your answer could potentially have changed, and that is, what are your top kitchen must-haves? This goes beyond basic appliances. You know, we're talking the cast iron skillets of the world.
For me, the list is still pretty simple, but I live with a smaller kitchen than I used to, so I space is of a premium. And so one of the things that I would put on my list, I've always said a good cutting board, because your knives are only as good as the cutting board that they're on, that you need a good wooden cutting board. Yes, you can cut on plastic, and in some cases where you're cutting up chicken or something, it's necessary. But to do real cuts, to do real serious, you know, precision cutting, dicing, mincing, things like that, you need a wooden board. You need a good wooden board, and I prefer rock maple. Speaking of knives, you know how I am. I'm
very particular.
Very, very particular about blades.
And every chef is, though.
Everybody's got their thing. You know what's funny, though? Some aren't. I think that some are like, look, buy me a Forstner stamp blade, wooden handle, the Tyrannox line, and just sharpen it a lot. I tend to look at a knife as an extension of my arm, and so I tend towards kind of boutique houses now. I'm so picky about knives that none of the mass makers do anything that I can really want to cut with.
But you also are local.
Well, I'm a big believer. You know, I've been using strictly cut Brooklyn for the last few years, but now I've seriously gotten into Bloodroot out of Athens, Georgia. So I do believe in finding local makers, local artisans that are making knives. You're going to pay for them. There's absolutely no question. You're not going to pay.
They're
going to last forever. They're going to be absolute things of beauty that you're going to want to display and use day in, day out. They will age with you, and you'll pass them on to your children. Cast iron, true, especially if you can get heirloom pieces and older pieces that are in good condition. But there are a few new American makers, Blank Creative, BLANC. In Virginia, I can't remember what town in Virginia they're in, that are making a new kind of small batch, I'd like to say, cast iron, and spectacular work. I mean, beautiful design, beautiful execution, and great metallurgy. So I think that there's, I've kind of added a local vore kind of vibe to my kitchen stuff. The other thing that is new to my must-have list is good containers. You know what? If I've learned anything, it's that, you know, if you're going to put time and effort into cooking, there are going to be leftovers, and you really need a good system for that. And I think that because anybody that's spent real time in restaurants, typically we gravitate towards Cambro, the manufacturer, there are a lot of, you know, restaurant depots out there in the world and restaurant supply stores where you can go and buy professional level storage
Amazon
devices. Sure, Amazon carries Cambro, absolutely true. And so I've become a super super big proponent of good storage pieces. So I would put that on my must have list as well.
Okay, see, I don't think everyone would have guessed that.
Yeah, probably not. I can see that because I haven't talked about it that much.
No,
but there you go.
It's not an extravagantly unique question, but a very useful one for readers.
Agreed.
All right. Continuing with the useful questions, another Twitter question. Any ideas on what skills should be taught to people with little to no experience in the kitchen in the beginning? Give your number one.
There was that jersey there. Twat. You brought it out. You brought out the jersey, girl.
Yes,
twat.
Here I am.
All right, so where do you start?
Yeah.
That depends completely on age, I think. You know, if you're starting them really young, then measuring. Yeah, because they're learning math, and you can really help kids learn math by teaching them to measure. You can teach them fractions, quarter of a cup, third of a cup, half of a cup, tablespoons, teaspoons. How many teaspoons in a tablespoon? How many adult Americans probably don't know how many teaspoons are in a tablespoon?
There's probably a lot.
You're there's, redder than your cocktail. Oh, you're reaching for your phone?
I'm not reaching
for my
phone. Is
three.
It four? Three.
Three.
All right, I was one
three
off.
Teaspoons to a tablespoon. So
one off.
You were one off. Oh, my gosh. That's, well.
My dad is cringing right
you're,
now.
You're my probably, cringing. Probably true. So, you know, measuring and stirring and mixing, and then you move them to knives. But for, and I believe that, you know, you really have to start kids off in the kitchen. If you don't get them while they're kids, it's really hard to get it to catch. It's kind of like learning a language. The older you are, the harder it is.
Yeah, I agree.
So stirring, basic physical things, measuring, and then getting into cutting, and then actual cooking. That is actually applying heat to food. That's the last thing that I would have a kid do, because that's where the potential for most danger is.
And what if it's an adult starting out in the kitchen?
Then I'd probably mix things together. It'd probably be more like, meaning it's like, okay, there's going to be some mixing here. There's going to be some measuring here. There's going to be some cutting here. And there's going to be some cooking here. Because adults at least know pan hot, ouchy, you know. You don't have to teach most people that. And so for adults, when they're starting, I tend to like to combine things. There's going to be some actual heat. There's going to be some sharp. There's going to be some mix. There's going to be some measure. And then you try to teach a basic precept, you know, like whether it's coagulation of proteins or the way that fats react to certain things or the way that carbohydrates do things. Or as simple as, you know, baking is such a great thing for teaching, because you get to teach the physical properties of mixing.
And accuracy is important.
And most people don't realize, you know, it's like creaming a cake. You know, the actual texture of a cake is determined not by the leavening as much as the creaming step itself. So, you know, being able to, I think adults learn better if you're like, you bringing something all the way to fruition. We are going to make a cake. Whereas kids, they can spend 12 hours mixing or stirring or whatever. So they're more about that particular activity. I want to do this right. I want to scoop more flour. Whether or not they realize they're making a cake, they don't care, typically.
You said something that actually gave me a question in my own head. You said the word ouchie.
Ouchie.
Do you remember your first ouchie in the kitchen?
I don't remember my first ouchie. I've been very fortunate to – I dislike ouchies so much that I haven't had that many ouchies. But most of the ouchies that I do remember were burns, not cuts.
Do you remember the worst one?
My first really bad one was in adulthood. I managed to not burn myself in the kitchen very badly until culinary school. Until I remember on my first internship where I had a was cooking some escargot in a rack, in a broiler rack underneath a grill station, and the escargot were in garlic butter, Pernod garlic butter actually, in these little escargot pans that would, if you lit them, if you set them on fire, they would actually go off like mortars. They would fly up, and I forgot that I had a pan of these things in, or dish of these things in, and I opened the broiler right as the is two of the escargot caught on fire and went off like mortars. And one of them literally came up, bounced off my glasses. So it would have gone in my, it was on fire, and then fell down and wedged under my watch and just burned a hole in my arm. And I had second degree burns, and guess what? Worked the rest of the shift.
Of course, that's what you have to do.
That's what you do. You don't get to stop for things like burns. But there were scars. I had a lot of scars in my arms up until, you know, I tend to heal well. So probably it took about 10 years for that scar to go away.
That internship was pretty rigorous.
That nearly killed me. I used to call the drive up to that restaurant, the Trail of Tears, because I cried going and coming.
It was a French restaurant, yes.
It was. Oh, my God, yes. He was so bad that France had actually kicked him out. because France was at the time part of the Geneva Convention, and this guy, there were some war crime issues probably, and so they kicked him out and he came to America. The French couldn't do it, couldn't put up with him.
But are you grateful that you went through it?
Mostly.
All right.
Mostly.
I'll take that.
That's all the questions that we have. That's it for this week. Well, thank you very much for sending your questions to us via the interwebs. That's all the time we have for the Alton Browncast. Thank you for listening, and we'll be here on the interwebs again
later. Now, go cook something.